Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. If you like this podcast, I need you to tell your friends about it, share it, or give it a review on Apple Podcasts. Certainly, you can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele and the podcast on Twitter at Steele underscore podcast. It's always a lot of fun when you do that. Just show me the love. That's all I'm asking. Help a brother out. So I'm excited about the conversation that I'm having today. It's a pretty heavy one. It's a weighty one by a young man who's written, I think, a very compelling book. Coleman Hughes, he's the author of the new book, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. He's a contributor at CNN and the Free Press, and he appeared on Forbes's 30 Under 30 list in 2021. We had, I think, a very compelling conversation around his ideas of a colorblind America, how we get there, what the new racism or neo-racism looks like as part of the anti-racist movement. There's a lot here that we tried to unpack. I hope you can be a part of that unpacking. So stay tuned for my conversation with Coleman Hughes right here on the Michael Steele Podcast right after this. Well, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. It's such a treat to have you back in the house. I'm so glad you could join us. I'm excited about our conversation with this brother who's kind of put a book out there that makes you go, makes you think, makes you reevaluate a lot of ideas you have around issues of race and economy and community. Coleman Hughes, welcome to the podcast, man. It's good to have you.
Good to be on, Michael.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the book is straight up, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. So help me contextualize what the end of race politics looks like.
Yeah. So the reason I wrote this book is because the idea of colorblindness has become anathema on the political left during my lifetime. People dismiss it as a naive idea, a way of ignoring race, a way of ignoring the fact of racism. I remember when I set out with the idea for this book as an experiment, I Googled colorblindness race so that I didn't get articles about visual colorblindness. Right. And I literally got 10 articles in a row saying why colorblindness was wrong, and not a single one defending it. But it always seemed to me that colorblindness, properly understood, which is to say, trying your best to treat people without regard to race, mm-hmm. knowing that this is not, this may not be achievable perfectly because right. human beings are flawed. Human beings, we're all right. capable of racial bias. Racism is a real thing. But holding that as the ideal and the goal to strive for, both in your personal life and public policy, that always seemed to me to be the idea that flowed right out of the civil rights movement that was, frankly, the liberal and correct progressive idea. And so to see that it had fallen so out of favor, it seemed it was really calling for someone to defend it wholeheartedly. And that's what I tried to do in this book.
So how do you... So I see where you're saying that the liberals, the left, have used it as a cudgel in many respects, and certainly as a marker for a lot of other things. How do you see the way it's used on the right to actually ignore, play down issues related to race and racism?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, Like any principle, the principle of colorblindness has been used falsely. It's been used by people as a false pretense. Mm-hmm. And there are examples of that in American history where, you know, purportedly colorblind policies were actually intended to disenfranchise Black people, for example. So, right. so for instance, literacy tests in the Jim Crow South were a colorblind policy, in the sense that they weren't directly discriminating, right? They were simply discriminating based on literacy, which is not inherently a racial test, but everyone knew what they were getting at. You know, it was colorblind was the pretext to get at the disenfranchisement of Black voters in particular. So that has happened, you know, no doubt. But I think people on the left have used those examples to reject the whole idea of colorblindness or the whole idea of race neutral policy, to say that because certain policies have been falsely colorblind, have used colorblindness as a pretext, therefore all colorblind policies are by definition racist. And I think that step is a really harmful logical leap, a rather illogical leap, and that we have to be moving towards a race neutral regime of public policy.
So what are some of the race-based policies that would fall into that colorblind category? And what have been their impacts from your examination of this? And as you sort of put together the sinews and the framing of your book?
So I think it's, I believe it's chapter three, where I go throughout academia, colleges, mm-hmm. corporate America, and government, and go sector by sector through the race-based policies that I view as harmful. I also spent a considerable amount of time on COVID policies that were race-based, handing out aid to failing restaurants on the basis of race and gender as opposed to financial need, and so forth. Many of the usual suspects come under fire, in my view, race-based affirmative action, which is almost a moot point at this point because of the Supreme Court decision. Mm-hmm. Race-based hiring and aggressive DEI programs. There's all sorts of policies that distort meritocracy and reject race neutrality in a kind of misplaced sense of righting historical wrongs.
But those historical wrongs are still a very sort of honest part of the conversation, and you still do have aspects certainly today more sophisticated than maybe 60 years ago of race-based public policies that strike at the heart of some of the meritorious arguments that are made. So, for example, when a young African-American male shows up for work and is presumed to be something other than an employee of that place, you know, how should those issues be addressed? How do we begin to deal with those aspects of race that still are a part of the consciousness of individuals when they see someone? So you as a young African-American male in 2024 are still likely to be judged by the police, by the economic structure, by the educational system, by the overall societal structure on your Blackness than your qualities, your capabilities, your merits. How do you begin to break that piece of it, which to be honest has no ideological home? All right, it is not a conservative thing or a liberal thing. It is a white Black thing. It is an Asian Jewish thing. It is whatever. However, the society starts to look at and color, if you will, the character of the content of your character, mm-hmm. because of the color of your skin. How does your book sort of walk us through those narratives that Because I, in a, at the end of the day, agree with you, but I still got to walk out my house and deal with being pulled over by a police officer or going into a shop or still today watching people, you know, clutch their purse or whatever when you walk by them.
So in my view, I can tell you my life experience. I'm just one person. I don't stand in for anyone other than myself. Having grown up upper middle class, looking the way, dressing the way I do, speaking the way I do, I've had relatively few of those experiences. Really, probably I could count them on one hand.
But you can and still count them.
Sure.
But that's the point, right?
Well, my point is that I think those experiences I've had really have not amounted to any notable or significant. They amounted to an annoyance at the time they happened at most, rather than an actual impediment to my success. Now, that wouldn't have been true of my grandfather's generation, who is probably almost 30 years older than you, and wouldn't have necessarily been true of your generation either. But really, all of it, you know, and frankly, many of those experiences haven't even been judgment by white people necessarily. You know, like some of them have been, certainly. But I know the one time in my life I've ever been wrongly accused of stealing something from a store in Times Square a couple of years ago, it was an African security guard that was accusing me of doing that.
Right.
And the truth is, I 100% understand the kind of road rage that you feel in those situations, because I felt it. Like when you know you've done nothing wrong, you know you belong in a place, and someone is judging you, and you're pretty darn sure they would not be judging you this way if you were white. That makes me angry. Like I feel that, you know, the sensation of just like wanting to curse them out and how dare you and screw you and all that.
Right.
It's not productive, but I understand the anger. However, it has not amounted to anything even close to a material deprivation or really, really the story of my life has much more been a story of being judged based on my merits, than being harmed as a result of being.
And so
white.
Your experience then sort of makes the argument, which you lay out in the book. And again, you know, the folks, the book is Arguments. I'm sorry, The End of Race Politics, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for Colorblind America. You do still kind of lay out in there sort of this idea of, and I guess this would apply to the experience that you had a couple of years ago, and maybe it is illustrative of the generational shift. My generation, I'm at the end of the baby boomers. So I'm the transition between the baby boomers, which was the largest generation after World War II, and every generation that's come after that. So we, and particularly having dealt with the tail end of civil rights, the tail end of a lot of the social upheaval, or in some cases having witnessed it firsthand on during our, you know, ages, you know, 15 to 30. You kind of, is that sort of the anti-racist movement or the neo-racism that you're referring to? What, how does that feature into this, or am I kind of not connecting that dot appropriately?
Well, but before I answer that, I think I want to add one more thing about what I was saying earlier, which is that I, you know, those incidents where someone thinks a black kid is stealing from a deli and he's not, or you know, run down the list of classic scenarios, I don't expect those to ever go away. And so I think,
well, what
that
are those? But here's the thing. Sorry to interrupt, but you strike me with a point there. If you don't expect those to ever go away, then you have to understand, I think, arguably, where does that come from, right?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And then how then do you ultimately, because if that person that you have that encounter with is a guard in a supermarket, what about the CEO of the company who has that same attitude? How do you then avoid the institutionalization of that attitude when you admit that it will never go away, and therefore there still remains this element of racism that prevents the expression of a colorblind society? Because while you may be able to walk in that store, and yes, you may be accused of stealing something when you didn't, downstream, you may not get that job. You may not get that promotion. You may not see the benefits, even though you're there and you have the merits to be there. You still may not realize the full potential of your experience there because that attitude exists above you. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, well, so I view it differently. If I were to trade places with the African security guard, what is more likely, that he has a kind of self-hatred or racism, or he's brainwashed by white supremacy, or that the neighborhood he works in there, the vast majority of people stealing things do happen to be black or Hispanic, and that he's become cynical and has a short fuse and essentially has begun to profile as a result of his day-to-day experience? That's way more likely to me than that he is the old school style American racist that has a racial ideology. And so I don't necessarily think that what in the moment, none of that matters to me because I'm pissed off at being falsely accused. But I can switch places with him and understand why he's doing that, likely, right? And it's not really the same as so would the CEO of that organization even have the same attitude, even have a reason to have that same attitude? Not necessarily. If anything, the CEO, if we're talking about modern day, is more probably more likely to want to really find the best black talent and diversify his if only for appearances, the C-suite at his company.
But again, if only for appearances, see, you shave and create the exception possibility. If that CEO is hiring blacks only for appearances, then it has nothing to do with merit. It has nothing to do with anything other than keeping other white folks off his back, or keeping, other African Americans and minority groups off his back. How does that speak to the lived experience, the professional experience of that individual in that space? If the attitude of the leadership is what you just described.
Yeah, well, I think it becomes a you begin to have a less than simple relationship with the place you work, because if there's 100% chance, if I just know you're hiring me because I was the best candidate for the job, forget how I know it, I just know it. That creates a different dynamic between me and my workplace. I know that I'm needed there. I know that I'm the best that for the rate that I'm charging, as opposed to if there's an unspoken sense that I've been hired, let's say an executive got into trouble over some race-based issue at work and said, okay, I'm going to hire someone to get people off my back, and I'm that person that's now coming in. Well, to what extent am I necessary? What is it that I bring to the institution? Well, the institution has told me, not in so many words, that what I bring is my race. And some people are comfortable with that, and some people are not. But it complicates the relationship between an institution and an employee.
Okay, so what situations or considerations do you think exist, or maybe they don't, excuse me, where race will matter and is taken into consideration, and so there's that, and then where should, for example, color blindness be applied? So you have these two
It's a great
spaces.
question. Great question. So in the book, I kind of use the analogy of police versus firefighters. If you have a police force, hypothetically, let's say you had a police force that was almost entirely white, policing a city like New York, which is heavily non-white. I would argue that probably just doesn't work, because in order for the police to do their job, they have to be viewed as legitimate by the population they're policing. Really, you can't really police a population by force. You have to have buy-in in the community. And if a Black or Hispanic community sees nothing but white cops all day, it's very difficult for the police to effectively do their job. So you actually did have this situation in the 60s and early 70s in some places, where you had almost entirely white police forces policing Black neighborhoods, right. Hispanic neighborhoods. In that situation, it makes perfect sense to really do whatever you have to do to diversify the police force, because it's difficult for the police to perform their jobs. And let's say it's the case that you have some police exam, and if you just apply it meritocratically, you only get 3% Black cops. Well, that's a situation where I'm going to say you got to figure out some way to increase the diversity of this police force, even if it means compromising on meritocracy in the short run. So that's a job like policing where I think diversity is probably necessary for the job to be done correctly. Now, go to a job like firefighting. I'm not sure it matters to, you know, obviously most of what firefighters do is not put out fires. It's other stuff, but really the whole suite of tasks they do, it's not really necessary that the firefighting force look any kind of way. And I think probably most jobs fall into that category, where I don't really see why it's important that your company have a certain look.
So if the fire department decides they don't want to hire any Black or Hispanic firefighters, that's okay?
No, that would be illegal. That would be illegal. My point is that if at the end of a meritocratic process, a specific fire department finds they have very few Black firefighters or Hispanic firefighters, I don't think they need to compromise on meritocracy in order to achieve that.
Okay, so, and why would you not compromise there, but compromise in the other instance? If meritocracy, for those who argue merit, if meritocracy is the thing that you value most, why would you devalue it in one situation and hold its value in another?
So I wouldn't say meritocracy is what I value the most. I place all of these principles in a wider set of trying to understand what is the ideal society. I feel meritocracy is a pretty good default attitude towards hiring, towards college admissions. But like any principle, there are situations where you should violate it. So for example, I'm against torture, but if you tell me there's a nuke in Times Square and I got to torture the guy to figure out how to stop it, I'm going to torture the guy. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean so principles have exceptions. And my view is that meritocracy should basically be the default principle, except in those cases where you have a really important job that actually can't be done effectively unless there is racial diversity in that workforce. And I think policing is an example.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I see your point there, and it makes sense, as they say, on paper. Mm-hmm. But we don't live on paper, right? We live in the real, and the real is a very different environment in which the question becomes one of, going back on the meritocracy point, for the young African-American girl who decides along her, you know, life, you know, early life, that she wants to be that firefighter, then how do you incentivize the process to level up her education, level up her exposure, experience, so that she can move seamlessly into that space based on her merits, based on all the other parameters that may be set, so that that 3% becomes 30%.
Right. Yeah. So that's, to me, that is where the real project is. That's where the real project of racial equality should be. And in my final chapter, I talk about ways that we can improve the really the lever we have to pull mainly is education. That's the lever you have to pull in terms of the state, right? Unfortunately, so much of what determines someone's level of privilege, level of success is what's going on in the home. Do you have two parents? Do you have, I had lucky to have two college educated parents, functional marriage, functional family, yada, yada. A lot of people don't have that. The state can't really intervene and give you that. And we wouldn't even want them to, you know, in a way. But what the state can do is fix failing school systems. I think too much of our conversation on racial equality has dealt with all of these controversial policies that apply post 18 years old, talking corporate DEI, affirmative action in college admissions, and so forth. I think really the point in life where the state can have the biggest impact is ages 0 to 18. And that's where really the majority of our conversation and intervention should be focused. I cite one paper by the economist Roland Fryer, where he was able to take over, I'm not sure any other experiments like this have ever been done, but he was able to really fully take over 10 failing public schools in Houston and do whatever he wanted as if there were no unions. So he fired half the teachers, fired all the principals, extended the school day, things like that. And he was able to raise test scores a really significant amount for precisely the kinds of kids who most need it. So my most of our attention and scholarship and resources should be directed towards those kinds of projects.
So why don't we do more of what you just described? Why? Because this is where I align with you on a lot of what you've written in terms of, this idea of creating a space in which you and I as Black men, two generations, can function in this world, in this country, in a way in which we never have to give a thought to that in our engagement with other people, with our engagement with official folks like police, our engagement through the work structure, right? Going out and getting a job, but most especially in our access and ability to create a lane for ourselves from the very beginning of life formation, educational formation rather, K through 18. University level, we can have a conversation about that. I know of a whole lot of very, very smart people who've invented and created a whole lot of things and didn't go to college. But at the same time, that's another piece of it. So why don't we seemingly still get that piece correct? Because in some respects, and I was very cognizant of this when I was raising my sons, of how even in the private school system, young Black boys are taught and treated. And there is a difference. There is a difference. And unless parents, and I'm sure your parents were probably attuned to this at a certain level, are on top of that, there are things that slip and slide and become baggage for them later in life. And I'm thinking of a young man in my family who, because of, who his family is, they project onto him behaviors that he never exhibited. So if he, for example, raised his voice or, boys play rough on the playground, play too rough, it was immediately interpreted as aggressive. And he was hauled off and had to account for that aggressive behavior. So there are little things like that that are still part of this system in the education of Black children. And you give an example of where someone goes in and changes the system. So why don't we, as a Black community, lean more into that and recognize how our own are progressing or not progressing through this system?
You know, it's a good question. I think the answer is different depending on whether you're talking about the political right or the political left. The political right, I think, mostly has given up on courting black voters in most
My
cases.
great frustration, my friend.
Yeah. So it doesn't really serve a Republican, the typical Republican, it doesn't serve their interest to prioritize an issue like K through 12 education for poor kids or much less black or Hispanic kids or the intersection of the two. On the left, it's a little bit more puzzling because you would think that this Roland Fryer study would be sort of like on everyone's lips. But it's really not. It's actually not known, and there's not much interest in it. And we're talking about an award-winning a black Harvard economist. You would think it's a no-brainer, but there is generally less interest among the political class in K through 12 solutions. Look, it could be as simple as the fact that you don't vote till you're 18, so that constituency's even if kids really knew exactly what they needed, which they often don't, they aren't who the political class is has to be responsive to. So in a way, it kind of makes sense that all the things that pop in after age 18, the affirmative action, the DEI, this kind of stuff is the focus because the voters who benefit from those or stand to lose if those are eliminated, are able to vote. 5-year-olds can't vote, so they don't really have a voice,
They have a
even
voice, huh?
though interventions at that age would probably be the deeper cures to some of our racial ills.
The book is The End of Race Politics: Arguments for Colorblind America. Coleman Hughes is the author. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to break down a little bit more of this really compelling writing, and sort of issue raising, if you will, that Coleman has kind of put out there. More with Coleman Hughes right after this.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele podcast. We've been having a very good conversation. This has been very sobering in a lot of ways because, Coleman, we don't really sort of take the time to talk about all of the nuance that goes into racial politics and race in America. That when you consider issues like, okay, how do we get to a colorblind point? I love that when Barack Obama got elected, everyone was like, oh, now we've reached a colorblind society. We've elected a black man. I'm like, no, baby, we haven't done that. We're nowhere near that. Stop it. But yet, and still, people look for and gravitate towards these quick fixes. The arguments that I make, and I think you do as well, in the book, really focus around the work that you have that's also involved in this, and in trying to get, the country to that place. I think you've touched on a couple of cases already. What should be, if you could just do the magic wand thing and kind of really kind of get into people's heads after 248 years of America, and even more so, more time of, blacks and on this land, that it's time to move on to something else, that we can be more enlightened in this area than we are. What would you say? How would you begin to do it? Does it rest in your generation? Do you see those elements in your generation of political leadership, economic leadership, societal leadership, what you see on, crazy as it sounds, on spaces like TikTok. I see a lot of folks kind of, you know, breaking down barriers in those spaces. You know, that's mm-hmm. a way where you kind of put something up and see how people react, and you kind of get the vibe of where people go. How, I mean, what tools, what messaging do you think needs to happen right now?
So one of my big disagreements with some recent best-selling authors on this topic is that I think children are generally born with the correct attitude about race. Most, you know, children are not born.
I mean, it's neutral. They don't care. They don't recognize it. They don't see it. And I agree with you 1,000. I just had this conversation. Let me cut you off real quick, but just to make a point, I agree with you 1,000% because I had that conversation yesterday with a friend of mine making that exact same point. So, but go ahead and continue.
Yeah. So, you know, kids aren't born perfect in every way. I'm not one of those, but you know, kids are often selfish. You need to teach them to share,
right,
this kind of thing. That's a very common problem. But they are not born with ideas about what different colors of people are like. They're not born with racial stereotypes unless they're taught those stereotypes. Right. They are, you know, quite often born, you know, almost literally colorblind in the sense that, you know, you'll see, and I've heard stories and seen examples of this where you'll have a white kid that you ask him who, you know, which one of his classmates looks most like him, and he'll pick a black kid because they have similar ears. Right. And because mm-hmm. he's not even thinking in terms of skin color as the most salient feature yet at that age. So, you know, kids are obviously, they're interested. They'll be like, oh, that's a vanilla person. That's a chocolate person, but it doesn't mean anything deeper than that,
right,
which is actually the correct attitude. If I could wave a magic wand and give everyone in the world that attitude towards race, that would go a very long way to solving things. But the hope, there's always hope in the fact that each new generation is a kind of a blank slate, in the sense that if we get our act together as adults and reinforce that attitude at a, mm-hmm. at a young age. And I think, you know, Martin Luther King is the best way to do that. I think, you know, every school in the country should play the I Have a Dream speech on Martin Luther King Day every year. It just reinforces, I think, what kids probably already feel, whether they know it or not, which is it's never okay to judge people on the color of their skin one way or the other. You do that, I think it's very possible to raise a generation of children that don't have the racial hangups that older generations do.
It's interesting you say that, because when you were talking, I wanted to go find in the book something that you touched on that touches on what you just said. It's in chapter 4, Why Neo-Racism is Spreading. Mm-hmm. And you make note, prior to 2013, most blacks and whites in America thought race relations were good. The trend line showed that fewer and fewer blacks every year saw racial discrimination as a big issue. Then everything changed. We saw a tenfold increase in mentions of race and racism, despite every indication that viewpoints about actual racism against blacks was trending downward. Why then did people's perception of race relations take a nosedive in 2013? You give the answer in the book, but I want you to give the answer here, because I thought that was very interesting, what you say here.
Yeah, so my view of, the data is very clear on this. Really, from around the time I was born, say 90, 95, 96, until 2013, every year was better than the last in terms of how Americans perceived race. And that goes for Black Americans as well. We were on the way to exactly where we needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything reversed starting in 2013. And it's that trend line has just been nosediving since. So the question is, what happened? I think many Republicans like to blame Obama, and I don't mm-hmm. think it was his fault. I think Democrats like to blame Trump. I don't think it was his fault. Mm-hmm. I think what happened really is around 2013, there was a technological revolution, which is that suddenly everyone had a smartphone. A smartphone with a camera and with a Facebook app and a Twitter app on it. And I suppose probably Gen Z is not old enough to remember what life was like before that. But, you know, in 2007, if there was an arrest between a white cop and a black suspect, and it ended in a struggle, the cop fired his gun, or, you know, any permutation of what can happen when something goes wrong. How do you find out about that? Well, if it happens in Arkansas, it'll be in the Arkansas local paper the next day. Maybe people in Arkansas will see it on their local 7 o'clock news the next day. By the time they see it, it will have gone through a journalistic filter, which will have asked the police their side of the story, the family their side of the story, and so warded off some of the most obvious misinterpretations of what happened. Probably nobody filmed it. Maybe it's on a body camera, maybe not. Say that same thing happens in the year 2013, 2014, 2015. What happens is probably someone started filming it on their camera-enabled smartphone halfway through the event, probably missed the lead up to the event. So there'll be some context missing. Then they post it to Facebook 10 minutes later, and it's got a million views, and it's algorithmically boosted so that the algorithm is going to show it to the very people who are going to be most angered by it, because that's how you get engagement. Fundamentally, this is a change in how information spreads and in what information you see and in how you see it. And as a result of this massive technological revolution, you get, in starting in 2013, you get the BLM movement. You get an upsurge in identity politics, an upsurge in the sense that racism is on the rise, that white supremacy is back, that it's open season on the police killing unarmed black men. And once enough people believe that, that creates an opening for some of these kind of race obsessed ideologies, critical race theory, and so forth, to get a much wider audience. And that's really what happened. Now, the question is, does that perception, one of two things could be happening. Either people are getting the false impression that racism is on the rise when it's actually not, or they're finally seeing all the racism that's actually out there. Now, a lot of people would say the latter. I would say the former, because I cite one survey in the book. If it were the case that we're now just seeing all the racism that's really out there, then you would expect people in the age of social media to be more informed about the basics of the basic facts. But in fact, you see the opposite. So, for example, I think it was in 2019, a survey asked the most online Americans, who are liberal, very liberal Americans, how many unarmed black people do you think get killed by the cops this year? And that, the answer was like 1,000. Their answer was like 1,000. The true number was something like 12. So clearly social media, the whole ecosystem, was giving people a false sense that racism was exploding, but a very believable sense, because we were all seeing the videos, right? And we weren't seeing videos of these things happening to white people, even though those videos actually are out there. If you search, they weren't showing up in your social media feed. And so that's what has set race relations back at least a generation.
What do you say to people who look at an event? And so let's take January 6th, and this is something that's very prevalent then and still to this day, as you have two groups of people, white folks and black folks, looking at the same event. And the white folks see patriots. Now swap out the insurrectionists on January 6th with Black Lives Matter activists and Black Panther activists and just general black folks who are there because they're upset about the condition in their community, et cetera, et cetera. The same reasons that animated a lot of the white folks who showed up. What do you think the outcome would be? Would they be the same?
If the January 6th rioters were all black?
Yeah.
It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, would they have been just allowed to waltz around the Capitol like they were?
Everything like, you saw white folks do, these black folks are doing. How do you think the institutions respond to it?
Well, to be fair, all left-wing institutions have responded to January 6th with extreme condemnation, appropriately so. I think. So it's really only right-wing institutions that have even been tempted to apologize for the January 6 rioters, right?
When did they apologize for January 6th?
So I mean, I mean be apologists for.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. All right.
So the Jan 6 rioters have been condemned properly by all the left-leaning institutions, which I agree with. I think January 6 was an absolute shame. And not a single one of those people was patriots, frankly.
Right.
But I also feel very strongly against the BLM rioters of the summer of 2020, destroying property, saying it's not a big deal, creating violence. I condemn that in the extreme as well. So I feel I have a consistent set of books about it, though. Probably there are hypocrites on both sides of that issue. In other words, there are people that apologize for the one and not the other
Right.
on both sides.
But they still haven't answered my question.
Oh, so when you say the
So
institutions,
how do you,
what
because the
institutions are you
point
talking about?
I'm talking about the core of what I'm getting at is really sort of standing back and saying that we still have this pervasive view in our country, regardless of other efforts, whether it's Dr. King or Malcolm X, or anyone else, when it comes to how Blacks ultimately engage in the society, the consequences and the results are always, not all, I won't say always, I won't paint with a very, very broad brush, but I'll slightly broad brush, are mostly different. So you heard and still hear today in talking with African Americans that if that group were black, that there would have been more bodies that day. There would have been a much harsher response that day. So the question becomes, well, why do black people still think that way? Why do we still believe that? That would be our plight if we behaved the way those white folks did on January 6th, that the cops wouldn't have just moved the gates aside, said, come on in. The cops seeing us storming through the halls wouldn't stand aside. The video we see of police smiling and welcoming the rioters. I have some questions about the character of those particular officers, and maybe they're politically aligned with them, and that's why that happened. But I'm just curious in the context of what you've written and studied, how you evaluate that attitude that is still prevalent in our community when we see how white folks respond to their own versus how they respond to us.
So that's a very good question. And I have a kind of complicated take on it. Because on the one hand, I do find it hard to believe the Capitol Police would have reacted the same way to a black crowd. Just intuitively, I think seeing a mostly or entirely black crowd encroach on the Capitol would have set something off in them such that they would have acted more like police and less like tour guides. So I agree with that. I don't have a way of proving that. That's just a
Right.
gut. That's just a gut instinct. Now, on the other hand, I really think that black people who think this way, white people who think this way, ought to question this narrative. Okay. So first of all, there's the fact that actually someone was killed at the Capitol. She was a white woman,
Right.
Ashley Babbitt, right?
Right.
People don't like to talk about that, but
Right.
it happened. And she was, to my knowledge, the only person who was actually killed by a police officer at that event. And so the question is, whereas how many in the series of protests that swept the nation and riots that swept the entire nation for weeks or months in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, how many people were killed? How many rioters were killed? That's a genuine question. I actually don't know the answer to that, but I don't recall seeing that it was open season on
It
our
wasn't open
black
season, but
rioters.
there was harsher engagement in encountering those folks, which some would say. Now, look,
a lot of those folks were white. And a lot of the most violent ones were white. If we're talking about Seattle and Portland,
because that's where I wanted to go. Coleman, thank you for that. Yeah. Because that's where I wanted to go. Because that's the other side of this scenario, which is. I'm just trying to sort of lay this out in a way in which we can look at it from the different angles and really kind of understand what we're talking about. Because whether you're talking about students on college campuses regarding Palestine at these elite universities, you're talking about the BLM, riots and disturbances in the summer of 22, was it 20. That within all of these instances, and probably including, because we know you had the Proud Boys and others who were prepared to engage militarily, if you will, all right, on January 6th. You have these other interests that come in and distort the outcome. In other words, they engage in behavior that is not the intended behavior of the folks who organize it. No one organizes to go start burning down buildings, because at that point you're losing the very audience that you're trying to convince or the message you're trying to convey. So that's a big part of it, true. But you then also do have a general, at least perception, and that's really what I'm trying to get at. Because we can talk what actually is, but that still doesn't address the perception that you and I would be handled differently if we go out here and walk down the middle of a street during a riot with a semi-automatic weapon, kill three people. I guarantee you we're not going to get acquitted. You're certainly not going to have Republicans necessarily rally to and make your cause celeb. So all of this kind of feeds the perception.
Well, I agree with the second part. I agree with the second part 100%. But
I'm just, my point is, let me finish, but I'll let you tear it apart. The point is that there is a general perception that you and I will be treated differently based on our behavior, but especially based on our skin in connection with our skin color in connection with our behavior. So that's the perception, which is what I was getting at. That how do you begin to break that perception so that it's the same outcome regardless of whether you're black or white?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I don't know how to break that perception other than to try to be honest to the best of my ability about the reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, I think I agree again that, like, you know, a black crowd outside the Capitol would have been treated more harshly than that crowd was. That's just a gut instinct I have based on who I think the police are and how they would react. Now, to the question of I think in the Chaz Chop Zone in Seattle, you literally did have pictures of, I remember seeing a picture of a black man with what looked to me a serious weapon, something bigger than a pistol. I'm not a gun guy, but was allowed to have the run of the place. As far as I know, I know that Kenneth Walker, Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, who shot a cop because he didn't know it was a cop, which I defended him, by the way, because I think no knock raids are ridiculous. How are you supposed to know if it's a cop if they don't announce themselves?
Right.
He had a legal gun. Anyway, the point is he was acquitted, right? Black man shot a white cop and was acquitted. Of course, people don't talk about that. That doesn't seep into the consciousness.
But isn't that more of a one-off? I mean, that's...
Okay, well, you can dismiss everything as a one-off.
There are people that
have the exact opposite perception because, for example, Tony Timpa killed in Dallas with a knee on his back for 13 minutes with the cops making fun of him. The closest to the George Floyd video of any video that exists, really. Mm-hmm. White guy, nobody cares. Even though it's filmed, no protests, no nothing. Similar thing happens to a black person and the whole world erupts. You have protests in New Zealand. Right. So there are people that would come, come at it from the other side and say, okay, well, if you want to play the skin color double standard game, let's talk about the fact that the only victims of police violence people know are the black ones, even though there are white ones every year. There's Dylan Noble. There's countless others that you can see, horrible films you can see on YouTube about this kind of stuff. And it's only when it's a black person that people care. And so I think this the point can be made both ways.
Isn't that caring that you refer to tied to history? The reason they care Yes. is because there's such a prevalent history of that, of lynching of black men, of all other types of atrocities going back to 1619, if you will. So there is a prevalent stain / history of that. So yeah, though that stands out more than the white kid in the similar situation. Do you think that that's what part of that is feeding? Because I'm really fascinated by your framing in the book around these issues, and I happen to agree with a lot of that framing. But I'm also kind of torn, trying to figure out which way on the other side of this, because we know what happens when we walk out the door. We know how institutions behave. We know how individuals behave. And we know what the history has done. And so how do we begin to reframe that narrative so that your sons and daughters, and I will admit it's better for my sons than it was when I was coming through. And it's better arguably for each generation, right? We can see that progress, but it's still part of the thread. It's still there. And it's tied to history, yes, but it's also tied to a lot of what you talk about in terms of it being taught. You know, you're not born this way. You don't come out hating white folks or hating black folks. So there are a lot of other pieces that we need to figure out and account for in this journey towards a colorblind society.
So I agree with you that history and the historical narrative that Americans know, the fact that even people who didn't live through it have seen those videos of cops hosing down civil rights protesters and so forth, all of that is the reason why people react more strongly to a white cop killing a black person than the reverse.
Right.
The further question, though, is that double standard justified? Is that double standard a good basis for the future of American race relations? I don't think it is. I think you can explain something without justifying it. Certainly that explains it. But ultimately we have to get to a point where we are not treating similar scenarios vastly different mm-hmm. based on the color of a person's skin for whatever reason.
So last question before I let you get on with your good stuff. How do you see the story ending? How do you see us progressing, given what we see in this political climate right now as we head into a presidential election? And I'm not, trying to get into the crazy of crazies, but just looking at where America finds itself, how the issues that you raise in your book and some of which we've talked about, how do you see us moving from here, and what should be a next step that would get us better footing on the right path towards what you're talking about as a colorblind society, which again could be realized more fully by your children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I hope that my book and my message can be part of helping people fully and clearly express why colorblindness is the proper end goal, the proper North Star for thinking about race and racial identity. I hope that people feel more comfortable expressing support for race neutral policy and certain policies can be done on the basis of socioeconomics and class rather than race if we want to talk about disadvantage and correcting for disadvantage. I hope frankly, I hope I can really help rescue the Democratic Party and people on the left from becoming fully wed to the race-based thinking, race-based remedies that the Democratic, that the leftmost wing of the Democratic Party is in favor of. And I hope that we can all agree on raising the next generation of children to have to rather than to inherit the racial hangups and anxieties and paranoias and complexes that the older generations, myself included, have, to be a clean slate and to nurture that sense of racial innocence that they're born with.
Appreciate you, brother. I really do. I really, really like listening to your thinking. And I think it challenged me in some of my perceptions, again, born out of experience, yes, but also tied to what others perceive, right? Mm-hmm. That you kind of take that in and you talk a little bit about that. But the end of race politics is a good place to start the conversation, I think, and you have begun that conversation by making the arguments for colorblind America. And I appreciate it, folks. This young brother is worth your time and attention. Get a copy of the book and read it with a cup of coffee, right? Which I did. Appreciate what you're hearing from the future, which is speaking to us now. And I think that's important. When I see young people like yourself who are moving comfortably into an uncomfortable space, I do that all day long. And I appreciate that. So I hope you appreciate what your voice is doing, because sometimes people can get tripped up on misreading your intent and misunderstanding your words. That can become a distraction to you. Don't let that happen.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you having me on your show. It's an honor to get to talk to you.
No, absolutely. The book, again, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. Coleman Hughes is the author. Folks, get a copy. Thank you so much for joining us in this conversation. Hopefully you got something out of it. I did. And share it when we drop it. Make sure your friends talk about it. Get a copy of the book and read and understand what this young man is talking about, what his brother's bringing to the conversation for us to move off of where we are right now into something a little bit better. Until next time, y'all, be safe, be well, take care. It's almost summer. The equinox is coming. I'm so excited I can go work on my tan. All right, guys, talk to you later.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.